This podcast is brought to you by EverythingVoluntary.com.
As my friend Anthony Gregory aptly observes, the winner in last week's presidential election was George W. Bush. The end of the Cold War complicated life dramatically for the military-industrial complex and for those committed to the enhancement of the national security state. And, of course, coincidentally, those were often the same people. Overwhelmed by ethnic conflict and the knowledge and incentive problems that beset hierarchies everywhere, the Soviet Union collapsed. The threat of global domination by what Ronald Reagan called the evil empire could no longer be used to mobilize support for bloated defense budgets, intelligence agency mischief, overseas coups, and assaults on freedom at home. For politicians and intellectuals committed to the American regime of global dominance through military power, the 1990s were depressing and disappointing. There was very little public enthusiasm for a renewal of the seemingly permanent war footing that had been in evidence from 1945 to 1990. George W. Bush changed all that. Americans, he said, were caught up in a global struggle he labeled a war on terror. The convenient thing, if you haven't thought about it, about identifying terrorism as America's foe was that there was no clear terminus for the war Bush had initiated. There was no clear way of specifying victory, no enemy to collapse. That means the war can go on indefinitely. It would always be possible to find new monsters to destroy. Americans could always be frightened anew by talk about the threat posed by a new terrorist bogey. And the violence of the war on terror itself, of course, birthed new opposition to the American empire and thus new enemies for Bush's war to confront and crush. As it prosecuted this war, the Bush administration simultaneously began an assault on civil liberties, undertaking a massive program of surveillance. It found ways to deny those who opposed it on the battlefields created by its invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan the legal rights normally accorded enemy soldiers, creating a new legal regime for enemy combatants. It gave us the odious Transportation Security Administration, denying us the chance to see our friends off at departure gates, forcing us to take off our belts and shoes and give up our toothpaste and nail clippers, and subjecting us to potentially dangerous electronic scans. It made aggressive use of so-called national security letters that demand private information about us while gagging those who might otherwise tell us we're being watched. It detained people without trial. It used the claimed state secrets privilege to deny the public knowledge of what it was doing. It encouraged torture and engaged in extraordinary rendition, one of the many euphemisms Americans came to find disturbingly familiar as the war on terror continued. Americans who called themselves progressives challenged what the Bush administration was doing. By the way, so also, as it happens, did many who called themselves conservatives, even if not people who wore the conservative label inside the Beltway. But they represented a variety of conservatism that had received little attention in America for over half a century. Progressive opponents of war and empire marched and protested and petitioned, waiting for an end to the Bush years and the war on terror. And then it seemed there might be light at the end of the tunnel. Barack Obama emerged during the 2008 Democratic primaries as the anti-Bush, young, intellectual, cosmopolitan, and inclined to talk about issues of war and peace in ways that seemed to portend a turn toward peace, toward the wider world. The Swedish Academy viewed him so enthusiastically that it presented him with an anticipatory peace prize. In fact, however, George W. Bush was reelected in November of 2008. The Obama administration not only continued Bush-era policies, even if sometimes with cosmetic changes, far worse, this is by far the worst thing about what it did, it normalized those policies. It transformed what progressive and conservative opponents of the war on terror has viewed as aberrations effected by one rogue administration into products of a bipartisan consensus. It should have been obvious to opponents of the warfare cum national security state that change wasn't in the offing when Democrats took control of Congress in 2006 and proceeded to do nothing to change the direction of Bush's policies. But if there was any doubt, the path undertaken by the Obama administration should have made it absolutely clear that the Bush administration's policies were here to stay. And this hasn't just been a matter of consolidation. It's been a matter of expansion. Imagine for a moment that George W. Bush had targeted Americans for drone assassination, or that American teenagers had been collateral victims of drone attacks. Imagine that George W. Bush had presided over the arrest and detention of Bradley Manning for the crime of telling the truth about criminal violence by the U.S. government. Perhaps, just perhaps, these kinds of abuses would have triggered renewed outrage on the part of the progressive opposition. Under Barack Obama, they seem to be greeted with little more than a yawn. I'd like to think that many Americans who see what's been happening really continue to believe that this is a bizarre and disappointing coincidence. Maybe next time things will be better. Maybe an insurgent candidate, Dennis Kucinich or Ron Paul or Ralph Nader or Gary Johnson or Jill Stein, will capture media attention and lead us all to a better world. Maybe Obama himself really wants to do the right thing, really wants to, if we'll just give him a little time and keep supporting him, if we'll let him finish the job. Individual politicians can affect the tone and perhaps to some limited degree the direction of public policy, but the problem is bigger than any individual politician. It's bigger than a political party or a movement. It's a function of the incentives politicians and their cronies confront. It's a function of the way states operate. It's important to recognize that people who become politicians aren't randomly selected members of the population. They are much more likely than the average to be ambitious and power-hungry. If they weren't, they wouldn't get elected. Consider the economist Frank Knight's quip that the probability of the people in power being individuals who would dislike the possession and exercise of power is on a level with the probability that an extremely tender-hearted person would get the job of whipping master on a slave plantation. And even if they're not, they're likely once in office to be subjected to pressure from actual and would-be cronies who want them to use power on their behalf. So it should come as no surprise that politicians like wars. Politicians engage in wars for multiple reasons. Warfare offers them glory. Have you ever noticed that historians consistently give wartime presidents the highest ratings? War also offers them and their cronies opportunities to grow wealthy, both as military contractors and as plunderers. Being a warmonger too often helps a politician gain or retain office, because doing so is frequently read as a sign of strength and as evidence that the politician will keep people safe. Warfare appeals to politicians' understanding of themselves as world changers. I mean, nothing offers a politician the same opportunity to remake the world as a war. A war gives those heading it the sense that they are, that what they do is unbelievably important. It enables politicians to mobilize popular support, to evoke popular loyalty in a way that would otherwise be impossible. And that's obviously tremendously appealing to politicians. It gives politicians opportunities to accomplish things, consider the passage of the USA Patriot Act, for instance, that they couldn't achieve otherwise, and it allows politicians to consolidate and indeed increase their power. In turn, wars are terribly destructive at home and abroad. As a general matter, it is, I believe, reasonable for people to use force to stop unjust attacks against themselves and others. And there's no reason to suppose that people can't or shouldn't cooperate with each other in the course of doing this. Now, it doesn't follow, of course, that it's always reasonable for them to do so even then. Most importantly, this may be because non-combatants might be injured in the course of an action involving the defensive use of force, even. It's not enough to avoid targeting non-combatants. This is something that military planners often say in a kind of routine, unthinking genuflection in the direction of just war theory. Well, we're not targeting any non-combatants, but one can obviously be certain, nonetheless, that those combatants will be harmed. If harming non-combatants is a byproduct or a side effect of an otherwise reasonable defensive action, this has to be taken into account, and it obviously can call the legitimacy of the whole enterprise into question. Roughly speaking, it seems to me that there is something entirely unreasonable about subjecting somebody to a risk of harm, even in the course of an otherwise reasonable defensive action, when one wouldn't be willing to see oneself or a loved one subjected to a comparable risk of harm in relevantly similar circumstances. What makes your life more valuable than that of the potential victim in this case? There seems to be a morally troubling arbitrariness about a willingness to tolerate collateral harm to strangers when one wouldn't judge it acceptable to suffer the same kind of harm oneself. This doesn't mean that causing collateral damage might never be acceptable, but it seems clear to me that it would very, very frequently not be reasonable to cause foreseen but unintended harms to non-combatants. And the way in which this is treated cavalierly by military planners and politicians is absolutely disgusting. Avoiding the risk of collateral damage is obviously not the only reason an individual might choose not to engage in an otherwise justifiable defensive use of force. There might be long-term consequences of choosing force, say the persistence of vendettas, for instance, or misunderstanding on the part of others that might be worth avoiding, just as there might be long-term consequences, of course, of avoiding defensive use of force when one needn't have avoided it. Increased possibilities for reconciliation, for instance, that might be worth embracing, but these don't change the fact that for individuals acting alone or cooperating voluntarily, the defensive use of force can sometimes be appropriate, but often isn't. State violence is a different matter for multiple reasons. So the most obvious, the most important here is lack of discrimination. Because state actors are rarely held personally responsible for the harms they cause in wartime, they are all too likely to cause indiscriminate injuries to non-combatants. Now, sometimes, of course, as in the cases of Hiroshima or Nagasaki, non-combatants are actually brutally, unjustly targeted. But even when they're not, they're harmed with alarming frequency, far more often than would be the case if state actors actually asked themselves whether they would be willing that they or their loved ones be subjected to the risks of collateral harm they're imposing on others. This is especially true when state actors opt for long-distance bombardment, whether from cannons, airplanes, or drones, as an alternative to on-the-ground engagement. Bombardment obviously has the capacity to decrease casualties on the side of those responsible for it, and so to reduce drains on the state's coffers and political problems for leaders overseeing war efforts. But it is morally dubious in the extreme because of its relatively indiscriminate character. Not surprisingly, then, war breeds resentment among those whose loved ones are killed, whose possessions are destroyed or stolen, whose societies come as a result of war to be dominated by autocrats, and this resentment, obviously, can lead to further violence. State actors' perceived need to mobilize and consolidate domestic support for war leads to the implementation of repressive measures, including censorship, propaganda, torture, surveillance, due process violations of all kinds. Not only are these troubling on their own, they are also all too likely to persist after war's official end. The ratchet effect is real. State-made wars are very frequently fought by conscripts. Conscription is, of course, a species of temporary enslavement, and employing it seems to be an unjust means to achieve any objective, even a potentially noble one. State actors tend, for predictable reasons, to undertake wars for dubious motives, for national or personal glory, for imperial dominance, or to further the nests of elite cronies. Now, it's obviously not the case that even good motives would justify the destructiveness of war on their own, but what's clear is that the motives are often very much not good, not even close. Okay, so The motives are bad enough, but too often, of course, at least some actors succeed in using war to extend their government's capacities for control and exploitation. High-flown rhetoric often masks imperial ambition, and would-be empire builders are happy to take advantage of opportunities provided by idealists in order to pursue their own dubious goals. Even when warmongers' motives are noble, as I doubt they almost ever are, lack of knowledge about the situation on the ground and the inherent unpredictability of the future trip up efforts to do good, a fact that circumstances in Libya today certainly serve to highlight. War making by states helps to birth all too intimate relationships between politicians, military leaders, and economic elites happily dependent on the money provided to pay for military equipment and other resources. The wealth siphoned off by these elites is often misspent, even from the perspective of those who favor war in principle, given the wastefulness and inefficiency of war production undertaken in tandem with the state. But it also gives them more access to and more influence over politicians, enabling them both to press for non-war related privileges, and also, and even more troublingly, to push for continued preparedness for war during peacetime, and even all too frequently for new hostilities. Since raising taxes overtly is politically unpopular, wars have increasingly come to be funded using inflationary money creation by state central banks. This ultimately functions much like a tax, but it's a hidden one. It destroys the value of people's savings, and it exerts distorting effects throughout the economy. Not very surprisingly, state actors who press for war, who oversee war, who promote war, aren't covering the costs of warfare themselves. Instead, they're asking others to do so. And this means, because they're not, in fact, internalizing the costs they impose on others, that it will be tempting for them to initiate wars unwisely without any regard for the likely costs. Once they have begun wars, they can be expected to overspend. They won't face pressures to economize. And, of course, this will lead those who desire wars and are responsible for them to continue these wars long after they would do so if the costs were internalized. War leaders responsible for conflicts for which they and their cronies can force other people to pay will confront incentives to use the vast sums of money that states at war typically claim to enrich those very cronies. Thus, not only will ordinary people be despoiled to fund politicians' war efforts, but resources will be misdirected from the uses to which ordinary people would prefer to put them. Tax or central bank-driven funding for warfare also means that it will be more likely to be carried out on a large, indeed a vast scale, with more troops, more weapons, more ambitious goals, and more willingness to remain engaged for longer periods. One practical effect, obviously, is that destruction will be increased. Another is that mistakes will be more likely, with potentially awful consequences. Now, I don't just mean targeting mistakes or other tactical errors per se. Rather, my concern is with long-term objectives. Now, you might consider, for instance, a group of volunteers like the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, folks who went to fight against the Franquista fascists during the Spanish Civil War. If we imagine something like that, that sort of group might well seek to turn back a tyrant. But state actors can delude themselves into thinking that they can remake an entire region of the world, as we know that many neocons seem to think would be possible as a result of the invasion of Iraq. Bigger military undertakings leave more room for errors of this kind, and the concomitant commitment of resources in utterly irrational ways in support of the continuation of such mistakes. The vast cost of state-driven wars leads to a massive misdirection of resources from productive to unproductive uses, minimizing opportunities for investment in productive activities that provide people with things they actually want and need. So there are multiple overlapping, reinforcing reasons for states to stay out of the war-making business. Further, these factors justify people in opposing plans for war on the part of states, even when they don't immediately see evidence of likely injustice, because state-made wars are so risky on multiple fronts. There are so many things wrong with war that it is clearly, I am convinced, by far the worst thing states do. And the thing that ought to make it clearest why it's good to be skeptical about the notion that the state is desirable. Thomas Hobbes, the great 17th century English philosopher and social theorist, wrote famously that life without the state would be solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. The state, he said, was needed to protect us in the war of all against all. In reality, however, it is the state itself that seems to intensify the risk of violence and to make it far more risky and destructive. Now, an argument against state-made wars is not in any sense an argument that individuals should never use force far from their homes to assist those who are victims of violence. But individuals acting in this way don't run most of the risks states do, and when they do confront parallel risks, these risks are considerably reduced as compared to those created by war-making states, particularly because such individuals and their voluntary supporters would unavoidably be expected to internalize the costs of their actions. They couldn't, as state actors do, externalize those costs on others. The fact that politicians can be expected to lead states to make wars, and that politicians are by definition those who make decisions for states, ought to make us suspicious of states, but we'll return to that in a moment. If you consider their track record, it should be clear in any case that states kill and conquer, that they're in the business of killing and conquering. Their militaries cause unbelievable destruction, and through a combination of military force, the use of dirty tricks, and the application of economic pressure, they dominate less powerful societies. So take an obvious example close to home. The U.S. government's declared and undeclared wars are all too often exercises in unjust imperial expansion. Empire building takes military, political, and economic forms. The government's wars are frequently imperial because they serve to extend its military power around the world, creating new alliances, new opportunities to locate bases and troops at every opportunity, making clear who's boss to anyone who might get out of line, and because they often seem calculated to extend the influence of American big business. So if you haven't done so, I encourage you to go online and Google "War is a Racket" by Smedley Butler, General Smedley Butler, two-time Medal of Honor winner, Marine Major General, who began to realize as his career continued that his time in the U.S. military had been spent serving as a shill for American big business. Butler's book is available for free. It is an absolutely invaluable look at the way in which military mischief was carried out in an earlier era. Things have only, I assure you, gotten worse. And the U.S. government's wars are not only destructive, but pointless, because they don't actually make Americans safer. Military interventions in Korea, Vietnam, Lebanon, Grenada, Iraq, the Balkans, Somalia, Afghanistan, none of these has served to protect Americans against attack. What they do instead is increasingly to breed hostility toward the U.S. government, and this means, unfortunately, even though you and I aren't responsible for what the murderers and thugs in Washington do, American people, ordinary American people, are targeted for violence. These wars don't spread American ideals, they tarnish them. Widespread collateral damage to noncombatants doesn't help, and U.S. government military interventions typically serve not to create or strengthen free societies, but to shore up authoritarian regimes more popular with decision makers in Washington because of their cooperative attitudes than because of any genuine commitment to the freedom and prosperity of their society's people. The threat of violence is the primary source of the state's internal power, but states repeatedly engage in violence outside their supposed borders. Now, nobody, I think, gets a free pass where morality is concerned. If it's unjust for you to do something in a given set of circumstances, then it's unjust for me to do the same thing in relevantly similar circumstances. By contrast, the state seems to operate on the premise that once in possession of the right sort of mandate, people can morally do all sorts of things they couldn't do otherwise. In fact, though, the fact that the state has ordered something to do something doesn't, per se, change the moral circumstances in which she acts. So that's why it's not hard to agree with Mark Twain's acid observation that all war and here I think he clearly means the kind of aggressive war in which states most frequently engage. All war, he says, must be just the killing of strangers against whom you feel no personal animosity, strangers whom in other circumstances you would help if you found them in trouble, and who would help you if you needed it. Otherwise, immoral conduct doesn't become acceptable when it's ordered by the state. I believe the use of force to defend oneself or others against violence is, as I've said, perfectly reasonable, but states recognize no such limitations. They wage war to dominate, threaten, retaliate, conquer. And this kind of war makes no sense. If state actors don't get any sort of exemption from the requirements of justice, what entitles them to attack and destroy when ordinary people can't do the same thing? I think we would all respond in horror if ordinary folks began attacking their neighbors, occupying their homes, making off with their possessions, confining them, and demanding tribute from them. But states do this kind of thing all the time. Once we see through the state's deceptive self-presentation, once we realize that state actors are just, as it were, your neighbors with guns, ordinary people with no more claim to authority than you have, we can see that there's no reason to go along with the state's aggressive wars or to regard them as anything but exercises in brutality. All sorts of reasons to oppose the state's war machine. Most fundamentally, of course, this ought to be obvious, but it needs to be underscored again, wars kill. States enslave prospective soldiers and exact tribute from people in order to fund their war machines. Wars give states excuses to expand their power. Wars lead to more wars. They break up families and communities. Start with the killing. Before the 20th century, state violence, which of course includes more than declared wars, but which will have been the work either of military personnel or of others acting under the state's orders, likely claimed between 89 million and 260 million lives. Between 89 and 260 million. Reasonable estimates place the total number of war-related deaths in the 20th century alone at over, possibly well over, 100 million people. So that 89 to 260 figure was for all time preceding the 20th century. The 100 million figure is just for the 20th century. Perhaps 15 million people died in or as a result of World War I. World War II may have claimed some 55 million lives. To focus on more recent events, documented non-combatant deaths in Iraq since the 2003 invasion total around 100,000. Over 31,000 U.S. government military personnel have been wounded in action, more than 4,200 military personnel, and over 1,100 contractors have been killed. So the other numbers, of course, the bigger number, is the number of ordinary people on the ground. Wars generate ballooning costs and feed a bloated state bureaucracy. It's not easy to estimate costs for wars throughout history, but World War I cost the participants some $2.6 trillion in today's dollars, while the inflation-adjusted bill for World War II seems to have been around $3.3 trillion. A Congressional Research Service analyst estimates that the United States government spent $341 billion in today's dollars on the Korean War and $738 billion in today's dollars on the Vietnam War. And this ignores various indirect and non-monetary costs, as well, of course, as the financial costs borne by non-Americans. We can't be certain just how much Americans will ultimately pay for war in Iraq and Afghanistan and for foreign military-based security upgrades initiated since the September 11, 2001 attacks, but a recent Congressional Research Service estimate suggests that expenditures approved from fiscal year 2001 through the middle of fiscal year 2010 totaled $1.121 trillion. That's roughly $400 per American per year, or $1,600 for a household of four. And remember that the U.S. government's war efforts are being paid for with borrowed money. The bill will be even higher when it finally comes due. Take a variety of indirect costs into account, and the hit, the financial hit alone, looks worse yet again. In fact, two economists, Linda Bilmes and Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz, have argued that the total cost of war in Iraq and Afghanistan could reach at least $3 trillion and will likely be higher than that. Barack Obama announced the end of combat operations in Iraq some time ago, but fancy that, some 50,000 U.S. government troops remain, and the president and congressional leaders remain committed to a protracted war in Afghanistan. Whoever wins election after election, the war party wins. That party is still spending what grandiose would-be wise men like to call blood and treasure in support of its goals. Wars create new opportunities for the abusive exercise of power. Revolutionary War-era state governments created conscription programs and executed deserters without trial. Would-be warmongers passed the Alien and Sedition Act at the end of the 18th century to suppress criticism of policies with the potential to lead to war. Both sides in the Civil War implemented conscription programs and imposed criminal penalties on vocal dissenters. During World War I, Woodrow Wilson promised that a firm hand of stern repression would be used against putatively disloyal opponents. The U.S. government rounded up domestic radicals in large numbers, prosecuting people just for expressing opposition to the war. If you're really bored sometime and you want to be shocked, take a moment, Google is your friend, to look up civil liberties and World War I, and you will find an amazing display in what seems like recent memory of brutal, naked power used to suppress dissent. The overt attack on civil liberties during the relatively brief period of American involvement in World War I is just remarkable. Of course, the abuses didn't stop there. World War II provided military and political leaders in the U.S. with excuses to intern people simply because of their Japanese backgrounds, without any determination of individual risks, and anti-sedition legislation provided cover for crackdowns on free speech. Cold War-era prosecutions and persecutions of leftists with no actual involvement in espionage or in Soviet plans for imperial expansion are painfully well known. Vietnam-era groups opposed to the state's Southeast Asian adventurism were targeted by law enforcement agencies for infiltration and manipulation, and people were prosecuted simply for the symbolic act of burning draft cards. War still provides excuses for human rights abuses. Before George Bush announced a global war on terror, had you ever heard of waterboarding? Now, it didn't start with Bush. And it didn't start, as regards the U.S. government, with Bush. If you read materials from the Spanish-American War, you will find that waterboarding was used aggressively by U.S. occupation forces in the Philippines. But most people didn't, understandably, remember that. What about extraordinary rendition? Was that a term anybody had ever heard before? Did it ever occur to you that agents of the U.S. government would force defenseless prisoners to feel like they were drowning? Did you think U.S. government personnel would capture people and hand them over to agents of foreign governments who would beat and torture them? Did you imagine that money you paid in taxes would be used to create black sites around the world, purportedly outside the Constitution's reach, where prisoners could be held without trial? We've all become better acquainted with the slick euphemisms the government can use to hide brutality. Some of the worst abuses of the Bush years may be over, but Barack Obama's first inaugural address, we haven't heard the second one yet, told us that Bush's war on terror wasn't over. The Obama administration had every intention of continuing it. The Obama administration has made clear that it has no intention of prosecuting Bush-era torturers. Now, there's some reason to think that its rules preclude torture by U.S. government workers, though who's actually investigating, but not necessarily by foreigners at U.S. government sites. The administration has used carefully crafted rhetoric to distance itself from its predecessor's awful human rights record while still keeping its own options open. And you should be aware, if you're not, that representatives of the Bush administration praise the Obama administration for its stance on war and terrorism. You'll find people like law professor Jack Goldsmith, formerly a highly placed Bush administration lawyer, or even Darth Cheney himself, telling you that, in fact, the Obama administration has adopted the Bush administration's own position. Of course, the problem doesn't stop at the water's edge. Is there anything more fun than waiting in an airport security line for a humiliating search? Do you like knowing that guards are keeping your friends and family members from walking through security checkpoints with you to your departure gate. Aren't you glad to know that government agents have been listening in on American cell phones or issuing national security letters demanding people's private information while prohibiting anyone from revealing the fact that they've obtained it? Freedom was the first casualty of the American state's undeclared war. As a senator, Barack Obama supported reauthorization of the USA Patriot Act, despite the fact that he had earlier noted civil liberties problems with the law. And he signed up to support the FISA Amendment Act, which purported to make warrantless wiretaps legal and gave telecoms a free pass for helping out with the Bush administration's domestic surveillance program. War gives the state an excuse to hide information from the public. Remember when the Department of Justice argued that because a case involved state secrets, the entire case should be dismissed? It said the government's claimed state secrets privilege could justify keeping the government itself from being sued over abuses that could only be discovered in virtue of the revelation of state secrets. That's, folks, that's the Obama Department of Justice. During his presidential campaign, Obama criticized the Bush administration for its expansive reading of the state secrets privilege, but his own DOJ has taken the same position as its Bush-era predecessor. The government claims it needs the state secrets privilege and other secrecy rules to keep us safe from our adversaries in the war on terror, adversaries you and I never sought out. But the principal effect of these secrecy rules is, in fact, to keep us from holding them accountable. These rules make it easier for fraud, violations of civil liberties, and torture to go undetected and unremedied. Randolph Bourne famously observed that a war is the health of the state. The War Party uses the endless war on terror, which does little to keep Americans safe, but which does foster intense anti-American sentiment by casting the U.S. government in the role of a global bully, as an excuse to justify the abuse of human rights, the erosion of freedom, the wasteful expenditure of our money, and the expansion of executive power, hiding abuses from view by appealing to the supposed value and importance of state secrecy. In wartime, the state seeks to silence or marginalize dissenters, dismissing those who oppose the official story as unpatriotic or even traitorous. Dissidents are branded as dangerous, put on watch lists, ridiculed, and harassed. They may not be imprisoned, as some were during World War I, but establishment cronies and apologists in the mainstream media treat them as silly, naive, and so obviously wrong that they may be effectively silenced, their voices inaudible to most ordinary people. Wars lead to even more violence. Military intervention and political manipulation in the Middle East, most recently the two-front war in Iraq and Afghanistan, has led to passionate antipathy to the U.S. government across the region and the Muslim world. Ongoing terror campaigns, folks, don't reflect some mythical distaste for American decadence. George W. Bush famously said, "They hate us for our freedoms," and I respond, "Nonsense." These campaigns are focused intensely on the goal of dislodging U.S. government soldiers and military investments from the region. Public statements identified as originating with the al-Qaeda terrorist network consistently justify terrorist attacks as responses to military action, to the U.S. government's long-term ongoing intervention in Iraq, for instance, and the presence of its armed forces in Saudi Arabia. Do you remember when Madeleine Albright, soon to become Bill Clinton's Secretary of State, famously said that maintaining an embargo that led to the deaths of Iraqi children was, quote, worth it because it contained Saddam Hussein? Would you guess that boosted pro-American sentiment in Iraq? One of the defendants in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing case said the same thing. The 2010 Times Square would-be bomber made the same point again. Now, I want to be absolutely clear. All purposeful or indiscriminate attacks on noncombatants are wrong. There are no exceptions. This is not in any way a justification for terrorist violence. But terrorist violence directed at American noncombatants is explicable. We can understand why it occurs, even though it is entirely unjustified. It's not a product of visceral hatred for American freedoms, nor is it part of some sinister master plan for the conquest of the world. It is a direct response to perceived injustice and violence in war. Shift gears. A consequence you might not have thought of. Wars break up military families. The mobility required to make a standing army work puts enormous pressure on family life. This is a point I owe to the great journalist and commentator Bill Kaufman. It also makes communities unstable, as military personnel with a lot to contribute to their communities are unable to put down the roots they need to invest emotionally and financially in those communities. Ironically, many of the same conservatives who trumpet their pro-family credentials seem entirely unconcerned that their support for a bloated military establishment comes at a high price for many real-world families. There's no way around it. Whether Americans like it or not, the United States has become an enormous global empire. Obviously, U.S. government imperialism doesn't look just like, say, British government imperialism. In general, the U.S. government doesn't attempt directly to control millions of square miles of territory outside the borders of the territory it claims is its own. And you realize the British Empire actually controlled, physically controlled, about one quarter of the world's land area. That's not the way the U.S. empire works. A recent study by an English journalist revealed that at one point or another, 90% of the countries in the world had been invaded by England. It's probably a little more subtle as regards U.S. government imperialism. What happens here is that whether through military action, political manipulation, support for coup plotters, or economic pressure, it encourages the installation and continuance in office of regimes friendly to its interests. Sometimes these regimes seem relatively free, and sometimes they don't. What matters to the people who hold the empire's reins is to create and maintain a network of allies who can offer access to resources and markets, sites for military bases, and support for other strategic goals. Other considerations are secondary. War and empire go hand in hand. War is as common an instrument of imperial expansion as it is a means of defense. Indeed, it's much more common as a means of imperial expansion. The story of the growth of imperial power is a story not of peaceful alliances, but of war and conquest. Alexander built the Macedonian Empire not with the understanding of philosophy he gained as a student of Aristotle, but with his skills as a ruthless general. Rome dominated the Mediterranean world because its troops suppressed alternative sources of power and stayed to maintain order and threaten violence. Spain and Portugal fought, burned, stole, and enslaved throughout Latin America. Military power created and maintained France's imperial presence in Western Africa and Southeast Asia. The sun never set on the British Empire because British troops conquered India, kept native peoples in check in North America and Africa, and patrolled the world on the ships of the incomparable Royal Navy. Consider the last five decades and focus for the moment just on the United States. It's not, of course, that the United States is the only international mischief maker, but the U.S. government is, in fact, the government that's been the most powerful in the world, at least since the end of World War II, and that means that what it does has a particularly dramatic impact on other societies. It makes especially clear what states can and likely will do with military resources. Not everybody has the power, not everybody has the military might, but it's good to look at what happens when an entity does have that power, does have that might, to see what actually occurs. The U.S. government wasted billions of dollars on its unjust war in Vietnam, in which between 3 and 4 million Vietnamese people and close to 60,000 Americans died. Many Americans sighed with relief when the war in Vietnam ended, but it was obvious that militarism and imperialism hadn't gone away. The unintended consequences of imperial overreach in Southeast Asia included bloodshed and totalitarian oppression in Cambodia. Just a few years later, the U.S. government sponsored thugs who tortured peasants and raped and murdered nuns. Then, of course, there were the first Gulf War and the imperialist intervention in the Balkans, masked as an exercise in what Noam Chomsky famously labeled the new military humanism. And to go back to the present, the Bush administration launched a disastrous, unjust invasion rooted in lies. And it used its declaration of an open-ended war on terrorism to excuse domestic surveillance, indefinite detention without trial, and torture. Now, the Obama administration is actively engaged in warfare in Afghanistan and Pakistan. There's ongoing talk about military activity in Syria. Hawks in Washington are looking for excuses to attack Iran. Commentators have blathered about a purported shift from hard to soft power. But state power is still ultimately the power to maim and kill. And the elites who want to use the power to extend their economic and political influence continue to set the agenda. They seem comfortable at home in both major American political parties. War isn't just a preoccupation of Republicans, Nixon, Reagan, Bush 1, Bush 2, or Democrats, Johnson, Clinton, now Obama. So instead of talking about the Republican Party or the Democratic Party as the culprit, we really ought to focus on the authentic villain of the piece, the war party. States support war with flimsy arguments and dubious propaganda. Remember, anybody here remember when Conan McKeough, propagandist for the invasion of Iraq, announced that U.S. government troops entering Baghdad would be greeted with sweets and flowers? How'd that work out? When Colin Powell told the UN Security Council that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction, when Tony Blair said Saddam Hussein could launch a nuclear attack in 45 minutes, when the Bush administration announced mission accomplished. Mainstream pundits implied that there was no choice but to invade Iraq, that events after the invasion would proceed smoothly, the democracy would break out across the Middle East, that the benevolence of the coalition invaders would be universally acclaimed. The facts have been, to say the least, different. And the ongoing dominance of the war party means we can count on more unjust, pointless wars and more attacks on our freedom and our pocketbooks. Standing armies are problematic, too. I abominate and detest the idea of a government where there is a standing army, early U.S. politician George Mason once said. For Luther Martin, one of Mason's contemporaries, it was obvious that, quote, when a government wishes to deprive its citizens of freedom and reduce them to slavery, it generally makes use of a standing army. Elbridge Gerry described a standing army as the bane of liberty. Thomas Jefferson included a ban on standing armies among the fetters against doing evil which no honest government, whatever that is, should decline. I think they were onto something. Standing armies, and I'm using armies here as a term of convenience to refer to all kinds of military forces, are armies not simply called up for defensive purposes in time of war, but maintained on a full-time basis. There's a natural connection between standing armies and states. States can afford to maintain large standing armies because they can support them using tax money. Standing armies are more likely to attract members when they're maintained by states because states can spend enormous amounts to promote recruitment. In addition, states can encourage people to join standing armies using propaganda that manipulates people's natural bent toward loyalty by focusing that loyalty not on people's own local communities, but rather on the state itself. By convincing people that it somehow, bizarrely, deserves their loyalty, and that that loyalty is best expressed through military service, the state can manipulate people into joining the military in a way that, say, a community association or a firm that provided security services could not. States need standing armies to drive their war machines. If a society features a voluntary militia to defend itself against invasion or violent civil unrest, the militia will do its work and then disband. Members of the militia will only participate in its activities if they believe it's doing something important, if it's defending their interests or those of their neighbors or friends. A standing army, by contrast, is ready to be deployed. It's waiting to be deployed. A state doesn't have to wait for an attack or the threat of an attack to make use of its standing army. If it wants to invade another country, orders for the invasion simply need to be passed along its military chain of command, and full-time soldiers and sailors will begin to do the jobs they've been told it's important that they perform. Personnel in a standing army are acculturated to think of themselves as performing invaluable tasks for their community, to trust and obey their superiors, to see what they do as an expression of loyalty. When the state snaps its fingers, they'll be likely to comply. By contrast, volunteer members of a militia aren't primarily soldiers or sailors. They're teachers or electricians or accountants, steelworkers, lawyers, journalists, plumbers. They have their own lives to live. This means both that they're likely to be resistant to attempts to persuade them to give up their ordinary lives to participate in war, and that they will have had considerable opportunity to develop independent perspectives on what's going on in the world. They won't have been subjected to constant propaganda to remind them of their role as the guardians of freedom, democracy, or the homeland. One of the most bizarre things, by the way, that the Bush administration did in the course of its propaganda war against the American people was to introduce this notion of homeland security. It sounds like something out of Central Europe in the 1930s. Americans have not been accustomed to talking about the homeland. It's suggestive instead of something like the German Heimat. And it continues to strike me as bizarre that this language persists, given how alien and out of place it feels. Anyway, a state has the resources to continually subject not only soldiers, but everyone else to constant propaganda in support of war. Once they decide on war, the state's leaders can use the enormous tax-generated resources at their disposal to convince the public that danger is imminent, that the intended enemies of the war they seek to undertake are evil, that justice is on their side, and that victory is certain. State officials enjoy an irrationally cultivated prestige that boosts their credibility when they propagandize for war. In addition, they repeatedly claim that they are in possession of information justifying military action which ordinary people lack, and that they therefore must simply be trusted. Just trust me. At the same time, they can maintain that they're unwilling to release this information more broadly because to do so would, purportedly, compromise everyone's safety. It's for your own good, they can announce. That's why we're not telling you, but take our word for it. States have, of course, another method for increasing the sizes of standing armies. They can enslave people. Older autocracies literally classified people as slaves, as state property, and sometimes forced them to fight. Of course, arming slaves is always risky since they might revolt. Modern states rarely call anyone a slave, but they are quite willing to demand involuntary work from people in the military. The state doesn't have to worry about whether people will regard a war as just or necessary, whether they will see the measures taken to ensure that they can perform their military jobs effectively as adequate, or whether they have other commitments that preclude military service. Well, sometimes. I mean, you may remember that Dick Cheney said he had other priorities during the Vietnam War, but I mean, that was different. The state is simply free to announce to people, as it often does, that they are required to join the military to work for low wages while accepting enormous risks. State-created standing armies also foster deference to and trust in authority. Ordinary people who defend their community while fighting in a militia return to their ordinary work and continue making their own decisions. People who are trained specifically to be soldiers, by contrast, learn to obey, to do what they're told without question. And that's one of the reasons many of the American founders distrusted standing armies. The kind of mindset required to be a good soldier isn't the same as the mindset required to be free and self-governing. States can use standing armies for repression, too. While the typical claim is that military forces are maintained somehow for defensive operations, they can easily be used to stop dissent and keep ordinary people in check. The state has the resources to invest in maintaining a powerful military machine, which it can proceed to use effectively at its discretion to beat, arrest, torture, and kill dissenters. There's a further problem. And I want to be careful here not to overgeneralize, but this is a real issue. Many people who leave the military become police officers. Now, I don't suppose there's any automatic connection between being on active duty or being a reservist and becoming a violent and abusive cop. But it's too easy for cops to treat ordinary people like enemies, and some kinds of military experiences can reinforce this tendency. Military organizations and high-pressure, combat-linked environments can encourage the dehumanization of perceived enemies, and people can bring their histories with them into civilian life. That doesn't mean at all that military service turns everyone into a violent thug. My dad was a member of the U.S. Army in World War II and posed, as far as I know, no threat to his neighbors when he returned. I don't fear for my life around my friends with military records. I just worry about ways in which some people can be disposed by some kinds of military experiences to behave with thuggish cruelty, both while in uniform and in civilian life. Drafting large numbers of people into the military is often praised as a means of building connections among people across barriers created by class, geography, culture, and ethnicity. Think about the vast numbers of war movies that focus on the theme of military service as undermining these barriers. But the shared experience of military service also serves another, darker purpose, as a way of encouraging large numbers of people to accept state violence and to identify as its servants with the imperial and military aims of the state. Think about the ways in which starting a war leads people, but especially those in the military, to jump on board to support whatever politicians do. Now, police officers' past military experience is hardly the only link between abuses of military power and abuses of police power. Police agencies are increasingly being encouraged to work with the military, and people are being prompted to think of policing and the use of military force as two sides of the same coin. There is some quite disturbing evidence that the Bush administration seriously considered dispatching military units to round up suspected terrorists on American soil. In a further erosion of the traditional and I think very wise prohibition on the use of military personnel for domestic law enforcement. I think we have every reason to be troubled when the state uses the power of its military forces against its own people, but we should hardly be surprised. The threat of force so clearly represented by the domestic use of a standing army is, after all, what makes the state the state. The great American dissenter Henry David Thoreau was surely right. Objections which have been brought against a standing army may also at last be brought against a standing government. The standing army is only an arm of the standing government. The government itself is equally liable to be abused and perverted. The real underlying problem is not the standing army, dangerous as that obviously is, but the state that maintains it. States can maintain standing armies when others couldn't because they can extract enormous amounts of money from people through the tax system, the inflationary creation of money, and other means dependent on their vast power over people's lives and possessions. State armies help to maintain and extend state power, engaging in terrible abuses along the way, abuses for which they are rarely, as long as they aren't defeated, held accountable. And service in these armies prepares people to participate as law enforcement officers after the completion of their military service in the suppression of opposition to the state. Imperial power is often spread at gunpoint, and even when it isn't, the awareness that military force is always available to back up an imperial power's demands helps to make sure people will comply with those demands. The U.S. government, for instance, maintains nearly 1,000 military bases around the world ready for action. 1,000 military bases. States also frequently use violent but less direct or overt means of forcing their wills on others. A state may propagandize for, fund, or actively manage a coup d'etat in another state. The fact that states have substantial financial resources and can employ many people skilled in violence and subterfuge makes it easy for them to manipulate events outside their borders. And the fact that the societies they seem to manipulate are almost all ruled by states, too, means they can focus their efforts on a relatively small number of people. When a state rules a society, all one needs to do to alter the society is to change the small number of people who make relevant decisions for the state, or to change their attitudes or motivations. Often, of course, not much changing is required. The elites who direct different states often have more in common with each other than they do with the people in whose interests they purport to act. Elites serve predictable interests. Imperial rulers and their corporate partners readily persuade local elites in client states to invest money taken from ordinary people by force or fraud in white elephant projects that may boost politicians' egos, but which primarily benefit not local economies, but politically connected multinationals. These same multinationals benefit when elites in developing societies force people off their land, leaving them little choice but to accept unsafe, low-paying jobs and little room to bargain for improved conditions. It's often a good deal less costly, financially and politically, for a powerful state to maintain an empire at a distance. Instead of actually occupying other states, stationing garrisons there, and assuming the burden of administering them, a powerful state can simply farm out this responsibility to local clients. It can cement ties with its client states using treaties, economic relationships, and the provision of military, technical, and other kinds of assistance. Then it can proclaim enthusiastically that, unlike other states, whichever ones it wants to differentiate itself from, it isn't an imperial power, but an open-handed partner. There are obvious PR advantages to proceeding this way. It's easy to convince the unwary that the empire really isn't an empire. The modern updated empire's seemingly consensual approach to gaining power contrasts starkly with the traditional empire's reliance on naked force. But the contrast is more apparent than real. The empire increasingly wears a friendly face, both because doing so keeps its own people and those it seeks to manage elsewhere from chafing too much under its rule, and because some of its leaders doubtless wish to believe that their exercise of power over others is really for those others' own good. An empire with a friendly face is doubtless less awful in some sense than empire at gunpoint, but whether they're maintained by war, the threat of war, covert manipulation, or just cozy relationships with local elites, empires unjustly redistribute resources to privileged elites and encourage ongoing acts of violence and dispossession. States kill and maim and destroy. The human capacity for violence is magnified, glorified, and protected from criticism by the state's military machine. And the state's wars, in turn, provide new opportunities for the state to grow, not only by expanding its boundaries, but by enlarging its administrative apparatus. Bureaucracies, in case you haven't noticed, never shrink. And the scope of its control over the people who inhabit the territory it claims. The permanent military forces only a state could afford to maintain instill fear at home and abroad and train people for obedience to arbitrary masters. And diplomatic and economic power, still backed by force and exercised in tandem with the economic elites who are the state's cronies, enable the imperial state to exercise influence beyond its borders inexpensively and while maintaining the illusion of amiability. The thing to recognize about war is that the problems with war are in large part problems with state action. War is especially bad, but things states do are persistently bad for the same general reasons. After all, for instance, it's not just in war that state action often involves unjust attacks on people's bodies. Think about the ways in which states fine and imprison people for victimless conduct or the violence in which state police forces engage. States snag people's land to benefit politicians' corporate cronies through eminent domain actions, not very different from the takeover of land in war. State actors' motivations are bad on the domestic front, just like they are when war and empire are concerned. Anyone who doubts politicians' motives when they make war should doubt them just as much when they frame and implement domestic policies. The consequences of state actors' choices aren't just destructive in war. Domestic policy choices can hamstring the economy and undermine people's freedom and dignity. Domestic policy, just like foreign and military policy, leads predictably to unanticipated consequences. Using large-scale power risks the production of unintended consequences unavoidably. Cronyism is very much a feature of domestic policy, just as it is of military policy. So think of the ways in which the Bush and Obama administrations both bailed out their corporate buddies, for instance. I still remember when the Bush administration was pressing for the Wall Street bailouts so many years ago. I remember calling frustratedly, fruitlessly, my local representative. Nothing happened. He voted for the bailouts both times. And when I looked at the list of people who had supported the bailouts, what was clear was that the leaders of both parties in Congress were on board. This is just what these people do. Politicians aren't forced to internalize the costs of domestic policy any more than they need to internalize the costs of foreign and military policy. Resources are consistently misallocated on the basis of politicians' own dubious goals rather than the knowledge people possess, ordinary people possess, at the grassroots. Now, as will be apparent, as I've tried to make clear, I'm not a pacifist, although I think there are powerful, whether or not finally persuasive, reasons to urge pacifist policies on states. The really first-rate George Mason University economist Brian Kaplan has offered some fairly careful arguments for why states ought to be encouraged consistently to function on the basis of pacifist constraints. Kaplan doesn't believe that individuals are somehow denied the right to defend themselves, but he does think there are good reasons why states ought not to engage in military action. But whether you think that or not, for anyone who believes that a society organized on the principle of peaceful, voluntary cooperation is the best kind of society, the only just kind of society, violence is something to be avoided and resisted. People can justly use force to defend themselves or others, though there will sometimes be moral reasons even for them not to do this. But whenever states engage in wars, even putatively just wars, holy wars, bad and frequently unjust things happen. The reference to holy wars, by the way, I encourage you to go online and Google holy wars and Howard Zinn. the late Howard Zinn, the historian probably best known for the book A People's History of the United States, gave this talk in multiple places. You can find text versions and video versions, and more than one version is probably worth looking at. But what Zinn does very powerfully is to look at what are often regarded as the most holy wars in American history and show why even those wars don't deserve our endorsement. Recognizing that state action in war is problematic means that state action in general is problematic. If we reject war, we ought to reject the entire state apparatus that goes along with it. You can have the state with its lust for empire, its capacity for empire building, and its destructive war machine, or you can move beyond it. People living without the state aren't likely to be more virtuous than people in today's world of warring states, but they will at least lack the opportunities for war and imperial expansion and the structural incentives to engage in both created by the existence of states. Without the state, there will still doubtless be acts of violence. But without tax-funded standing armies and all the other resources states can bring to bear, the destructive potential of human violence will be significantly reduced. And without state control and state control mechanisms to capture in war, the incentive for large-scale violence will be importantly diminished. Statelessness doesn't offer utopia, but it does offer more peace, more safety than the state. Thanks very much.
Will you do me a big favor? Will you rate and review this podcast wherever you're listening from? That really helps. And one more thing, please share the podcast with your friends.